I want to talk today about the life of Montana-born singer and writer Emmanuel Taylor Gordon, who was born in White Sulphur Springs in 1893. He left White Sulphur in 1910 and eventually found fame as a tenor singer, a specialist in the performance of African-American spirituals. Capitalizing on his success and celebrity status, he published a memoir, Born to Be, in 1929, that detailed his early life in White Sulphur Springs, his term of employment with circus impresario John Ringling, and his rise to fame. So I'll say a little bit at the beginning about his life in Montana, but I will focus the first part on outlining the story of Taylor's career, and then I'll come back to say a little bit more about his life in Montana, and particularly how he portrays that part of his life in Born to Be. So a little bit of the Gordon family history here. His father, John Francis Gordon, came to Montana Territory to work as a chef in mining camps, and he moved his growing family to White Sulphur Springs in 1885 when he began working as the head chef at the Higgins House Hotel, which had a fancy restaurant that catered to wealthy travelers who came to White Sulphur to take advantage of the hot springs. So his brother Robert was born actually in Cairo, Illinois. His sister Rose was the first Gordon child who was born in Montana in the mining camp of Barker. There's a gap there between George and Taylor. There was a sixth Gordon child who died in infancy, right, between those two. Taylor's father also would die in a railroad accident before Taylor was born, but the family continued to live in White Sulphur Springs even after the death of their father. His mother started a catering business in the early 1900s, opened the Gordon Notion Store and Restaurant. The Gordon Notion Store and Delicatessen on Main Street, which she operated with her daughter Rose, more or less continuously from around the turn of the century until just after World War II, there was a Gordon-owned store, cafe, or restaurant operating in White Sulphur Springs. Most of the Gordon children excelled in school. Rose Gordon had ambitions of being a nurse. Taylor, on the other hand, found school uninteresting, and as a teenager, he wanted to be a cowboy. Family friend C.H. Sherman helped him to begin realizing that ambition, although he never got much beyond the wannabe stage here. Although according to this clipping from the Mayor Republican, he was putting in some work toward that goal in 1908. Ultimately, Taylor was seduced by the possibilities offered by automobiles and trains, and in 1910, his desire to travel took him east. He had met John Ringling of Ringling Brothers Circus fame when Ringling was involved in a land development company in Muir County. And eventually, with Ringling's help, he entered a series of jobs that eventually found him in Ringling's employ in New York, which for the first time put Taylor in touch with the African American community in New York, where he met composer and violinist Will Marion Cook in a barber shop. So the drawings here are all illustrations from Born to Be, which were created by artist Miguel Covarrubias. So after a year of study with Cook, he started attending a music school settlement that opened in Harlem. The settlement music schools offer conservatory training to financially needy students. During this time, Taylor was also a member of the Salem Emmy Church Choir in Harlem. So he was getting a fairly wide-ranging musical education that involved both church music and classical music. Importantly, this is where he met J. Rosamond Johnson, who offered him a position in his touring vaudeville unit, J. Rosamond Johnson and the Inimitable Five, after Taylor's completion of his program. And this is sort of a close-up of postcard advertising one of the tours of Johnson's group. And you'll see Johnson seated there at the piano. The tall person is Taylor there in the middle between the two other singers for this quartet that was part of the group. So most black vaudevillians performed on what they called the Chitlin Circuit, playing in segregated theaters for mostly black audiences. The Inimitable Five played the mainstream circuit, and they were often the only African-American performers on a program. So a vaudeville program would have anywhere between 6 and 15 acts on it, right? Depending on the length of the length of the day's entertainment, you would just sort of go from act to act. They were also unusual, and they were regarded as the headliners, a privileged spot on the program that was only rarely accorded to black performers. So on the B.F. Keith circuit, they traveled around starting in the northeastern U.S., then into Canada. They went from Montreal to Vancouver, then traveled down the west coast to Los Angeles, then back east through the upper Midwest. This journey would take about 9 months, right, as they moved from place to place. As a featured soloist, Taylor gets his own individual photo on this publicity card. He's there in the center. And then you can maybe see him in the large group photo at the top, which has all of the group, including Rosamund Johnson at the piano. When he was there with the entire group, he played banjo. And you can see him there, I think, with a banjo in his hand. This is Johnson and Gordon. This is a publicity photo from around 1925. So J. Rosamund Johnson was a conservatory-trained musician who excelled in both classical and popular music. With his brother James Weldon Johnson, he formed a songwriting team that published hundreds of songs and wrote for multiple Broadway musicals in the early 1900s. They were the first African-American songwriters to have a songwriting contract with a major publisher. So I have a bit of an odd question for you. Did any of you see the documentary on Netflix of Beyoncé's Coachella performance? Not very many, a couple people have, right? So one of the songs she performed was Lift Every Voice and Sing, which Johnson & Johnson composed in 1900, which has been a staple of black community gatherings for nearly 120 years, which is why Beyoncé paid tribute to the song in her concert. So among Rosamund Johnson's many accomplishments, he also writes songs for Beyoncé. So the Johnson and Gordon concerts came about in part to promote Johnson's anthology of spirituals, the Book of American Negro Spirituals, which included traditional spirituals which he had arranged for piano and vocals. This was the innovation that Johnson brought to spirituals, folk music created by enslaved African Americans, sung in the early 20th century primarily in black churches. The era of the Harlem Renaissance in the 1920s started to see spirituals taken seriously as a unique and authentic example of American music. Choral groups such as the Fisk University Singers had for decades been performing spirituals, bringing them out of the African-American community to other audiences. But in the 1920s, the spirituals became mainstream. Renowned African-American tenor Roland Hayes had in the late 1910s started including a section of spirituals in his performance of European classical music. This was a daring move when he did it. Actually, being a black performer of classical music was daring enough. Roland Hayes, in 1923, with the Boston Symphony, became the first black performer to appear with a major orchestra. So that was in 1923, shortly before Johnson and Gordon began their performances. Most white audiences, that is, the audiences of most classical performances, had not encountered African-American spirituals, and if they had done so through the distorted medium of minstrel shows, in which white actors in blackface performed comic songs and skits. White audiences regarded spirituals, if they regarded them at all, as comic songs, as not something to be taken seriously. The revolution that Taylor Gordon participated in was this transformation in mainstream attitudes toward the spirituals as a form of music to take seriously, as an important branch of American music that belonged on the classical stage as much as the German Lieder that was Roland Hayes' specialty. As well as Roland Hayes and Taylor Gordon, the third male vocalist from the 1920s that's important to mention is Paul Robeson, right? Paul Robeson had an astonishingly long career that involved both theater and singing, as well as political activism. A year before Johnson and Gordon had their debut concert in 1925, Paul Robeson and pianist Lawrence Brown gave the first concert in the classical European format of pianist and vocalist devoted to spirituals in New York, right? And Johnson and Gordon followed them a year later at Garrick Theater on November 25th, 1925. So after the Garrick Theater debut, for the next 5 years, they became the preeminent interpreters of spirituals on the stage. In the 1920s, the presence of well-dressed African-American men seriously performing African-American folk music in a format usually reserved for European classical music in places, concert halls, recital halls, that usually excluded African-American performers was a significant breakthrough. White audiences had never heard anything quite like it, and in another era would have completely rejected it. But the time was right in the 1920s for a flourishing of African-American artists in a variety of fields, a movement subsequently called the Harlem Renaissance. Johnson and Gordon also brought something different to the performance of spirituals that neither Roland Hayes nor Paul Robeson offered. Hayes performed spirituals the way he performed German Lieder, with impeccable skill, precision, and refinement. Paul Robeson brought his warm but untrained baritone to his performances, and with pianist Lawrence Brown, brought a performance style that, in contrast to Hayes, drew on African-American musical tradition as much as it did on classical music. Robeson and Brown, as did Johnson and Gordon, performed songs using call and response techniques, with the pianist responding both instrumentally and vocally to the lead singer's lines. So in a conventional piano and vocalist format, the piano is the accompanist, right? Is not the lead singer, and sort of provides the background for the singer. These performances by Robeson and Brown and Johnson and Gordon were much more a collaborative effort between the pianist and the vocalists. Robeson and Gordon both sang in vernacular African-American English rather than standard English that was used by Hayes, for example. Taylor, much to the surprise of audiences trained to listening to classical performance, also improvised, adding shouts, hollers, yells to the songs. His use of falsetto, typical of spirituals performance in African-American churches, was an additional element of African-American musical style that he brought to the classical stage. So together, Johnson and Gordon brought an improvisational and collaborative element to their performances that was distinctly different from what audiences were used to experiencing on the concert hall stage. The combination of conservatory-trained musical skill combined with African-American performance elements helped make them a sensation in the 1920s. So February 16th, 1927, Johnson and Gordon gave the first concert devoted to the performance of African-American spirituals to be held at the world-famous Carnegie Hall. Johnson and Gordon contributed to breaking down the barriers in the world of classical music that kept African-American performers and African-American music from the most prestigious performance spaces. The Carnegie Hall concert was an important moment in the Harlem Renaissance, a moment that symbolized the achievement of important civil rights goals. The audience for the concert included African-American and white attendees, and even in New York, that was not the norm. Right? So the concert contributed to the greater goal of integration by having this mixed audience. If you can read some of the program there, this is a fairly typical Johnson and Gordon concert. They never exactly repeated the same program twice. They always like to mix it up. Didn't My Lord Deliver Daniel was almost always the first song at a Johnson and Gordon concert. Witness for My Lord was always the last. Taylor Gordon's signature song, Stand Still Jordan, ends the third set. The most familiar song on the program that you'll probably recognize is Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. They often didn't include that on the program, but saved it for encores, right, including their encores. So after the Carnegie Hall concert, they essentially got aboard a train to South Carolina and began this 1927 American tour. This was an ambitious 3-month tour of the country, including an Alabama concert at Tuskegee Institute, the school for African Americans established by Booker T. Washington, where they performed for an audience of 3,000 members. Other highlights included a concert here in Bozeman. Bozeman? Yes, I will point out that that is the error of the printer of the program and not mine. Taylor's brother, George, worked at the Elks Lodge and lived in Bozeman, and Taylor wanted to have the concert here in order to have so his brother could attend the concert. And although it's not on the list of engagements there. He also, after the Bozeman concert, went to White Sulphur Springs, where they gave a concert there for Taylor's hometown, during which, at one point, they brought his sister Rose on stage, right, and she joined them for a song or had a solo for a song. So they played everywhere on the West Coast, including several dates in San Francisco and Oakland. The tour ended back east in Massachusetts, where they were able to briefly catch their breath before heading overseas to France and England. And this is another illustration from Born to Be, in which Taylor confronts for the first time a bidet, right? So Taylor Gordon's autobiography, Born to Be, began as a letter to Carl Van Vechten that humorously described Taylor's first encounter with a bidet. Most of that letter ends up verbatim in Born to Be, although there are several additional sections in the letter that were too earthy for 1929 book publication. And I will say that I quote the whole letter in the biography. Carl Van Vechten shared the letter with friends who began encouraging Taylor to write the book that became Born to Be. So in addition to exploring French plumbing, they did a series of concerts in London, including two concerts at Wigmore Hall. And again, these were the first concerts devoted to African-American spirituals in England. As with the concert at Carnegie Hall, the Wigmore Hall concert in London was important in part because of the location, a fairly new concert hall at the time, but a very prestigious one. The sensation created by their two concerts there also resulted in a series of invitations to perform in private homes, including invitations from Somerset Maugham and Radcliffe Hall. They also had a two-week contract in July with the London Coliseum that, because of their popularity, was extended until the 1st of December. So they had planned to leave at the end of July and end up staying for several months because they were getting good pay from the London Coliseum and were getting good audiences. They also had several times when they were broadcast on the radio. So there are listings of radio performances that they did as well. So the accomplishments of Johnson and Gordon during this period, from their debut in November of 1925 through their return from England nearly 2 years later, is truly one of the unqualified artistic successes of the Harlem Renaissance period. During the 1925 to 1927 period, Johnson and Gordon did what no other performers had done, performing a staggering number of concerts devoted completely to African-American spirituals over a wide swath of geography that included most of the United States and parts of Europe. Born to Be, Taylor's autobiography, appeared in 1929 with quite a bit of fanfare, including a review in the New York Times and a Macy's window display on 34th Street with copies of the book, as well as original prints of Miguel Covarrubias' illustrations. He also attracted the attention of some literati, including Gertrude Stein, who was a big fan of the book, right, and sent her appreciation in this letter to Carl Van Vechten. After their tour ended in 1927, they continued to give concerts together, but they didn't go on any other sort of extensive tours like that again. What they started doing, actually, was radio. In 1929, Taylor was the featured singer on the Aunt Jemima Pancake Hour, which was broadcast on the NBC radio network. So the Aunt Jemima Pancake Hour, which featured Johnson and Gordon in skits and songs, was such a big hit that it produced a measurable increase in pancake flour sales. Right? The Aunt Jemima Pancake Hour was quite different from other programs. The producers hit upon the idea of working in references to Aunt Jemima Pancake Flour as part of the dialogue of the program rather than as separate advertisements. So among their other accomplishments, for better or worse, Johnson and Gordon were there at the birth of the technique of product placement advertising. The program also opened the door to other non-pancake flour-related radio opportunities, including the Dixie Echoes radio show on the CBS network, which was a national broadcast in prime time on Sunday and Monday evenings. If their concerts brought spirituals to thousands of listeners, Dixie Echoes expanded that audience to hundreds of thousands. So, and what happened next in Taylor Gordon's life is sort of the movement toward the end of his career, right, as a performer. Johnson and Gordon broke up in 1930. Taylor tells several different stories as to why they broke up. I'm not sure that I'm completely buying any of the stories that he tells. It could just be that after 12 years of performing together and traveling around the country together, they had had enough of one another, right? But they broke up. Johnson continued with the Dixie Echoes radio show, but Taylor went his own way. He continued to perform in concert, but I did want to list here some of the other accomplishments that he had in this period, including as a performer in musicals and plays, including perhaps most famously Gay Divorce with Fred Astaire in Claire Luce. Gay Divorce became the movie Gay Divorcee, which was pretty well-regarded Fred Astaire movie. And then his final role seems to have been in The Pursuit of Happiness in Philadelphia, which is several months in Philadelphia, which was set during the Revolutionary War. And Taylor reports that he had one line, which was to burst into the room and say, "The British are coming." So there are several reasons that his career came to an end in 1934. The Great Depression meant that fewer white patrons were willing to spend money on African-American artists. And in general, this affected a lot of different artists in the Harlem Renaissance. Performance spaces in Harlem also closed one after another, with the heat wave in the summer of 1934 contributing to the closing in most places. Personally, though, Taylor began to exhibit symptoms of the mental illness that would take over his life in the 1940s and 1950s. And that illness may have made him unreliable to hire as a performer. I can say more about this in the Q&A if anyone is interested, but Taylor suffered from paranoia and delusions. He came to believe that John Steinbeck had stolen the Grapes of Wrath from his own unpublished manuscript for a book called Deonda, right? I wish that I could say that I had uncovered a great literary crime, but I can't, right? His belief that his book was stolen from him is more a product of his mental illness than anything else. He was institutionalized in New York mental health hospitals on two occasions, from 1947 to 1948, and again from 1952 to 1959, right, a long period of time. And in 1959, he was released to the care of his sister Rose and returned to live in White Sulphur Springs. One of the primary reasons Taylor Gordon's career disappeared from the history of the 1920s is this period of mental illness. He literally disappeared from view, right? He was hidden away in an institution. He lost touch with all of his old friends. And as he disappeared from view, people started to forget about him. I want to go back a little bit and talk about Born to Be and about Taylor's life growing up in White Sulphur Springs, Montana, all right? So he says, "I was always the only black boy in my room. Sis and George attended school at the same time I did, but they were far ahead of me. I went as high as the eighth grade and quit. I look like a giant among pygmies. Besides, I like the outdoor life," right? "I knew I was black and different in appearance from most of the kids I played with, but my being so never changed the values of the game we might be playing. I got a chance to pitch or bat at the time. My merits won for me either positions." So from a 21st century perspective, I think it's likely we would take Taylor's statement about a prejudice-free White Sulphur Springs with a grain of salt. Taylor's portrayal of White Sulphur is important to the argument in Born to Be. In addition to telling entertaining stories, he also paints a detailed picture of racial prejudice in America, and he paints himself as an innocent in racial matters, which is quite effective as a strategy, as it allows him to show his readers the process he goes through in learning how to survive in a segregated society. He needs a prejudice-free White Sulphur Springs as an explanation for his own innocence. And he needs White Sulphur as a contrast to the rest of America, a vision of white people as they might be if they could get over their hangups about race. So, two points that might surprise you. Taylor's portrayal of the White Sulphur Springs of his childhood is not inaccurate, even if it's a bit rosy. Secondly, why Sulphur Springs was not nearly as white as he portrays it. He may indeed have been the only African-American in his classroom, but even in addition to his family, there were quite a few African-Americans living in the Springs, and they were all friends with the Gordon family. So maybe to place the Gordon family in a larger context here of African-American migration to Montana. So in 1880, the U.S. Census registers 346 African-Americans living in Montana. By 1890, that number had more than tripled. And continued to increase over the next decade. White Sulphur reflects that pattern. White Sulphur reflects that pattern. A fire destroyed records of the 1890 census, so we don't know the exact numbers for White Sulphur Springs. But looking at the newspapers of the period, it's possible that the African American citizens numbered more than the 30 registered in 1900 and 1910. I've encountered quite a few names in the White Sulphur Springs newspapers that don't appear on any census in Montana. So they were certainly there for a while. So in 1910, the African-American population in Montana began to slide. That was all across the state. And you see that reflected in White Sulphur Springs when by 1950, there were only two African-Americans left, Rose Gordon and Robert Gordon, brother and sister. So generally speaking, African Americans went west to escape violence and oppression in the South and East. However, as the West continued to be settled, the prejudiced African Americans left behind caught up with them, and they moved elsewhere. Right, that's part of what accounts for this sort of population rising and then dropping, and things were not perfect in White Sulphur Springs. Taylor says that he was the only African American in his classroom. At least through the 1880s, the classrooms in White Sulphur Springs were segregated, so they weren't white and black students in the same classroom. It's unclear when exactly integration of the classrooms took place, but sometime in the 1890s, maybe early in the 1890s, maybe as late as 1893 or 1894. So he's accurate in saying that he was integrated into the classroom, but that was not the case probably for his sisters and brothers, at least at the beginning of their schools, although they eventually were in these integrated classrooms. So studies of Western newspapers in the late 19th and early 20th centuries show that they reflected racial and ethnic biases within rapidly growing towns. In general, when reporting on African-American citizens, if they mentioned them at all, and most of them didn't, Western newspapers emphasize stories reflecting negative characteristics, fighting, drinking, or repeated stereotypes. The White Sulphur newspapers, the Mere Republican and the Rocky Mountain Husbandman, printed hundreds of positive items related to the Gordon family and other African Americans living in the Springs, which is one of the things that really surprised me as I was looking back through these newspapers. At the town's 1898 Memorial Day event, Joseph Meeks, who in the Civil War had served in the 54th Infantry out of Massachusetts. This was the segregated Union regiment that was famously depicted in the film Glory from a couple of decades ago, you might remember. But he was a member of that unit. So in 1898, at the Memorial Day event in the Springs, he was the standard bearer for the small group of Springs veterans. He carried the flag, right, on this Memorial Day event. Stories about him, Joseph Meeks, appear throughout the 1880s and 1890s, especially as he was a successful mine prospector. This item in the Mirror County News, this is from August 19, 1893, is just one of the many items over the years reporting on his activities. Another prominent African-American citizen of the Springs was Irwin Smith, who was born in slavery in Missouri, but migrated to Montana after emancipation. And he settled in White Sulphur in the early 1880s, where he was a successful business owner for over a decade operating a blacksmith shop. Right? This item from the Rocky Mountain Husbandman from 1884 is one of the many items that would appear about Smith. I think his blacksmith shop was actually located next to the newspaper office, and that probably helped him get a lot of sort of mentions in the newspaper. For the most part, he had a series of partners over 15 years or so. He usually partnered with white blacksmiths, right? They were the co-owners of these blacksmith shops. Although the newspaper record doesn't tell the whole story of race relations in White Sulphur Springs, it does suggest the way the Gordons and other African Americans were fairly well integrated into the town's public life, with the newspapers being an important part of that public life. Smith and Meeks, in their different fields, often join with white partners in their endeavors. In this case, with the Lady Gay Mine, Joseph Meeks' wife, Laura, joined in to form a business partnership between three African-American owners. This business venture suggests to me that in 1891, the partners believed that an African-American-owned enterprise could succeed without the protection a white partner might offer. Smith had retired from the blacksmith business by the time Taylor was six or seven, so it's possible Taylor didn't remember him. However, the Gordons and Meeks were friends, and Taylor mentions them in Born to Be, but he does not indicate that they were African American. Again, he's shaping his portrayal of White Sulphur Springs to contribute to his argument of the book, and that portrayal is accurate. He just doesn't tell us everything, right? He leaves things out for that portrayal. Then, I just wanted to show this little clipping from the paper. The newspapers started in the 1900s to print the school attendance records, right? Apparently there was a problem with absenteeism, and the newspapers thought they might help by giving some shout outs to the kids who made it at the time. And so you'll see, so Taylor's first name is Emmanuel. Growing up in the Springs, everybody called him Manny. And so you'll see there circled Manny Gordon for being neither absent nor tardy. And I'm going to show this clipping because it represents the only time Manny Gordon made the neither absent nor tardy list. Had there been a frequently absent or tardy list, Manny Gordon would have seen his name in the papers a lot more often. His brother George, on the other hand, is always there. So however long he lived in New York, Taylor always thought of himself as a Westerner. Being black in a predominantly white America made him an outsider in the United States. Growing up in Montana away from a large African-American community made him feel sometimes like an outsider in the African-American space that was Harlem in the 1920s. Only in the White Sulphur Springs of his birth did he seem to feel completely at home. In 1959, he was released from Central Islip State Hospital into the care of his sister Rose, who's pictured there with him. And he lived in White Sulphur Springs from 1959 until his death in 1971. Finally, back in his Montana home, he seemed to pick back up the life that had been disrupted by his mental illness. And for his final decade, he participated in White Sulphur Springs community life. He wrote a pamphlet on the history of the Sherman family for the Mirror County Historical Society. And the last time I was there, you could still buy the pamphlet at the Castle Museum. He participated in town centennial celebrations. And I think this is maybe what this photograph is one of those centennial celebrations. I believe Rose won a prize for her hat. Although he only gave a few full concerts, he continued to perform songs at weddings, funerals, and other community events. The last half of Taylor's life was a tragic story, but it had a happy ending as he found his way back to the home that he loved. As a sort of treat for you, this is sort of the story of Taylor Gordon's life. I'm going to step back a little bit more and talk a little bit about Taylor Gordon as a singer and about his most famous song, Stand Still Jordan. So Johnson and Gordon recorded several songs for a couple of recording companies. Test pressings were made of the records, but they didn't go to a general release. And those test pressings no longer seem to exist, or if they do exist, they're in somebody's attic somewhere. The only recordings we have of Taylor singing are from after he split from Johnson. These were made in a studio in New York that specialized in talking letters. Basically, you went in and you were recorded on a metal disc that was about this size. The company then gave you the disc. They also gave you a mailer to put it in so you could send the talking letter to whoever you wanted to. And they gave you a bag of wooden needles, which had to be inserted in a phonograph to play the disc. So whatever phonograph you had, you could play the disc on it. You just had to use the special wooden needles. They clearly also had a piano in the studio. As Taylor's post-Johnson accompanist, Vincent DeSala, plays on the recording. So as you might imagine, this metal disc and wooden needle process was not a high-fidelity playback system. So there's a lot of popping and crackling on these recordings. Stand Still Jordan was Taylor's signature song. Even just here in these opening measures, you'll note the use of vernacular language, stan rather than stand, distinctly different from other performers of spirituals who were in this European classical tradition who would be much more standard in their English. From the recording, you'll also get a sense of one of the qualities of Taylor's voice that a lot of reviewers talk about. They all mention this sort of the haunting, eerie quality of his singing, and I think you get a good sense of that haunting quality here. As an interpreter of song, he put the emphasis on emotion, on conveying a particular feeling. He was not as concerned about getting all the words correctly or even hitting all the notes correctly. If he wanted to stay on a note for a while and sort of shape the note for the emotion of the song, he would do that. There's a line in the song, I've got a mother in heaven. And that to me seems to be central to his interpretation of this song, that at least it feels to me like a song of mourning. And you'll get that sense of sorrow and sadness. Then at the end of the song, the last few measures here, there's an exemplary moment that illustrates the fusion of Black vernacular and European classical forms in Taylor's performance. With the final Jordan, this is a moment there in the opera when the tenor hits the high note and holds it, as Taylor will. And we get a full sense of the force and volume of the singer's power. And in Taylor's case, not only holds the note, but continues to add shape and texture to the sound. After that Jordan, right, we go to Lord, I Can't Stand Still for the last words of the song. But after the Jordan, he improvises. He adds a little shout that is not part of the score and is certainly out of keeping with European classical form, but very much an aspect of African-American music. And you might think about the shout when you hear it as to how to interpret it. It's kind of a sad shout, right, in some ways, but it also sort of feels like he's given himself a bit of a congratulatory note, a congratulatory shout in praise of having hit that note, right? So see what you think when you hear it.